Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about taking our pipelining ideas and applying them to our full YAD6 processor, the one that you'll be eventually building as a single cycle processor in a homework and then building as a pipeline processor in another homework. I'd like to start out by revisiting or talk about data hazard stalls from last time. So we had this idea that one way we're going to be able to deal with this instruction here, writing to R9, and then the next instruction wanting to read from R9 before that value is actually written, because we're executing different parts of the instruction at different times, by stalling. And we needed to do two things. We needed to keep the PC where it is because we wanted to remember that instruction that we still need to execute, that we're waiting for R9 to be written for. And we also needed to send something down the pipeline. The decode stage here, this register file read, needed to have something there to do, and we needed to give it something that wouldn't cause any harm, that would do nothing. And that was our dummy register numbers, 15. So that means that we need some logic in front of our PC to do this. So we'll have some MUX where we get our incremented PC, and we also get the old value to leave it unchanged. And we have some signal here that we're going to talk about how we set later this week or next week, saying, should we stall or not? And based on what that signal is, this MUX will either choose to not increment the PC or increment it. For our registers with our register numbers for the decode stage, we want sometimes to give that no-op value, that value which won't cause any harm, so we can at least have the stage do something that isn't like accidentally going to write registers or something like that. And we're going to need to decide whether or not we send the no-op bubble. And I'm going to call that sending the no-op value, and I'm going to call that bubbling. A bubble is something we put in the pipeline that does nothing. And we're going to have another MUX in front of there, which is going to decide whether to send the real value. Oh, I connected that wrong. That should not be a loop. Send the real value, which comes from not the previous instruction, comes from our logic or the no-op value. And it turns out that HTL2D, if you read the documentation, provides a MUX to send a default value and to send the previous value for you, for every single register bank. And it's controlled by signals called bubble. Bubble for send a default value. That's hopefully you set up the default value to not do anything harmful. And stall for just keep the previous value. So you'll use those more, but that's going to be a built-in feature just to handle these pipelining things. So you won't actually have to write those MUXes, but that's what's going to be there to handle this sort of stalling logic. Questions about this? Yeah. This should not be looping back like it does here, right? We want a third input to the MUX, which is different. That's all. So let's move on to adding registers to our full single cycle processor. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to take our processor and we're going to just drop registers in periodic intervals on it. We're just going to take every signal that's crossing those registers, crossing these big boxes where we put a register, and put them in a register between the stages. That's effectively all we need to do besides handling things like hazards. But there's a little bit of a tricky issue, which is that we have our PC computation. And previously, we got our PC just from the end. But that's not going to work. We don't want the instruction we started four cycles ago to decide what instruction we run next. You want the current instruction to decide that. So for most cases, we're going to want to somehow use the value from the instruction memory to decide what instruction we run next. And it turns out we can do that for most of our instructions. But we have two exceptions. For conditional jumps, yes, we can see in the instruction where that jump goes. But we don't know whether or not we actually want to do that or not. We don't know what the condition codes are going to be yet. And you might say, well, can't we just peek at wherever the condition code registers are? Well, we could. I could run a wire from the condition code registers, like here in the execute stage, and drop that value into here. I could do that. But the problem is that those are the condition codes from a couple instructions behind at the time we'd be looking at fetching the next instruction. So we're going to need to do something different, and I'll talk about what that is. Another issue is return. So for a return, we're going to get a value from the data memory and use that to decide what instruction to run. Usually that will be something which was put in the data memory by a previous call instruction. And well, we can't just take a wire from the data memory and send it here directly and get it at the same time, because again, we're getting whatever the instruction that's three behind us is reading from the data memory, not the actual address of the return value. And in the worst case, maybe we just execute a call instruction, and then we're executing a return instruction right after, so the value we want to read might not even be stored yet. So I'll talk about how we'll deal with that later. We're going to have to wait. So we'll have some line which goes from here to there to handle the return, but we're going to need some extra logic to make that actually work because we can't do it right away. We need to wait. And for the most part, the stages are exactly the ones we talked about earlier. But I'm going to mention a few things that are either different or tricky that wouldn't have come up when you were talking about our single cycle processor. So one that I kind of came across is that only most of our PC computation happens in the fetch stage. We're going to have to do a little work that's not in the fetch stage to compute our PCs. Another issue is writing the stat register. So in what you've been working on, it looks like you basically get something out of the instruction memory and just use that to set the stat register. That's not going to be a great idea. Because if we did that, then we'd take a halt instruction, and it would take effect before the instructions before it had finished their write back, for example. That would not be very useful. We don't want the halt instruction to take effect early. We want it to take effect after everything before it has actually finished. So we're going to write the stat register, at least for halt, in the write back step. The other thing is condition code reading and writing. So in our book's description of the processor, they are careful to do all the condition code setting and using the condition code values in the execute step, but it's less important until you have this pipeline processor. Here we better read and write condition codes in the execute step. So we have to write them no earlier than the execute step because that's when our computation happens, so we can't do it earlier. We better read them then, because if we use condition codes, you want them to be the most up-to-date version, the ones from, in the worst case, the previous instruction, the instruction that just computed it. So we need to wait till that instruction finishes the execute stage in order to have its condition codes. So we need to read it no earlier than execute, in the worst case. So we're going to do it from the execute step, because that's as soon as we can do it. And for things like jump, we're going to want to read the condition codes as soon as we can. So any questions about this? Our arrangement of stages? What happens in what stage? Okay. So, as I mentioned, we have registers that separate all these stages where we store values. And our book has a bit of a funny naming convention for these registers. So the signal, did I misname one of those? No. Okay. That's a DRA. The signal going into the registers that's going, I flopped these, but the signal coming out of the register is named with a capital letter in the stage. The signal going into the register is named with a lowercase register letter in the stage. This is just the convention the book uses. You and HCL to D is going to make that natural to do if you want, but you don't have to. But I will try to use that today just to be consistent with the book. Okay, so now that we've gone through this sort of preliminaries about how we're going to organize our processor and some naming conventions, let's talk about how we're going to update RPC. Let's start with a simple case. So this is what you did last week in lab, hopefully, where you get a value from the instruction memory, and you take the I code from the instruction memory, and you just use that to increment the PC by the appropriate amount. This is our simple PC update. But this doesn't handle all the cases. And you had a code which looked something like this, presumably. Do that in HCL, where you just specified each case and something to do to the PC. So we're going to need to extend that. But I'm going to first talk about, in general, what is our control logic going to look like? So in this case, we're deciding what to do based on the type of the instruction by looking at the I code. And that's going to be a natural thing we're going to want to do all the time. We're going to want to look at the I code and use that to decide what to do. And there's other places you might do that. So for example, an exercise we could have given you instead of updating the PC is deciding whether instructions read or write. So one thing we're going to need to do later in our processor is decide whether the input memory, the input in the data memory says, are we reading now, is true or not. And in our single cycle processor, you're just going to take that same I code we use for the PC update and use it. So, but that's not going to actually work. We're going to actually need to get that from a pipeline register, because we put pipeline registers and take every single thing that gets into this memory stage from the pipeline register. And that value from that the memory stage gets from the execute stage needs to come all the way from the instruction memory, and it needs to go through a register after each pipeline stage. So just because we need this part of the instruction memory, the I code, means that we're going to have to pass it through all those pipeline registers, even though on our diagram there's nothing to do with it, because we omitted this read and write signal. And that's going to be a common case. So where previously, if you were implementing the same thing for deciding read and write that we did for the PC, that lot in HCL to D, where you'd have our, depending on the I code, choose a different thing to add or a different value, you'd use just the I code. But here, we're going to have to set up all those registers. So we're going to have a register from fetch to decode, which has an I code in it. And we're going to pass the value all the way from the instruction memory into this register, into a sequence of registers to eventually get to the memory stage. And that's what we're going to end up using to decide whether it's a read operation or not. Because we don't want to make the decision based on the instruction that's a couple afterwards. We want to make it based on the instruction that we're currently doing a memory operation for. And so this is going to come up when we make our PC update logic, because part of our PC computation is going to happen in later stages. So as a preparation, we're going to need to make sure we know what to do in those later stages. And we're going to need to look at registers from those later stages to actually do our PC computation. So our general rule is that we're always going to be passing the iCode through in PyPI registers. Because even though it doesn't appear anywhere on the diagram I've shown you of the processor, or the books diagrams of the processor most of the time, we actually need that iCode to make decisions all the time about what we're doing in our instruction. We need to know, we have it to know what we're setting the status register to eventually. We need to have it to know what registers we're writing. We need to have it to know what we're doing with the memory. And we'll also have a bunch of other control logic, especially for handling hazards, where we're going to need that. We're going to need those instruction codes everywhere. You need to know like what's currently happening in the memory phase. What type of instruction is running? We're going to need to know that, and our source is going to be the value stored in these registers. And our general rule, just as with our rules about separating pipeline stages with registers all the time, is that when you're writing your HCL code for implementing the pipeline processor, you better only be using the prior stage's outputs and only be setting the inputs for the following stage, besides things which are in your stage, like if you're in the memory stage, the data memory. Otherwise, you should not be touching the values, with two exceptions. And these exceptions are cases where conceptually we need to send information between different instructions. And that's going to be the what instruction do we run next question. So to know what instruction to run next, we need to look at a different instruction than the one we're currently trying to execute. So that's a case where there's going to be an exception, and we're going to look at some stage that is not the instruction we're responsible for. And the other case is going to be handling data and control hazards. So we'll talk later about how we handle most data hazards, and that's going to require looking at information from multiple instructions to say, do these instructions actually conflict? But for actually doing the work of the instruction itself, you better not be looking at stages besides the outputs of the previous stage and the values you're providing to the next stage. Any questions about this sort of coding discipline? So with that in mind, let's look at what we're going to actually put in the pipeline registers besides just the iCode and the general rule for figuring out what our instructions do. And one way you can do this systematically, rather than trying to draw out what happens, is you can look at our book's sort of description of what happens in each stage of the instruction. And now, instead of just being a general guideline to separate the instruction into logical parts to make it easier, it's actually a rule about what happens when. Because we're going to separate these different steps with registers. And anything we pass between these steps is going to need to use a register. So that means, for example, we need RA here. So we're going to need to pass RA, which is not shown because the book likes omitting some signals. But RA comes from the fetch stage. We know that because it comes from the instruction memory. And since we use RA here, it better be in a pipeline register. Similarly, we use val A and val B as their names for the results of reading the register file. And that, as shown here, happens in the pipe in the decode stage. And we use val B in the execute stage and val A in the memory stage, which means that there better be a pipeline register for every stage in between which has those values. We also can look at val E here. That's computed in the execute stage, and it's used in the memory stage. So we better have a register that stores it between those two, because we're not allowed to just take the value directly because we're getting it for the wrong instruction. And we can do this for other instructions. So for the add instruction, we have something similar where we use RA and RB a whole bunch, all the way down to the write-back stage. So there better be some register which stores the value that we're writing back, all the way to the write-back stage, even though we don't use it in these middle stages. To get it to the write-back stage, we need to pass it all the way through, just like we saw with Desti earlier, when we talked about just doing add queue. And similarly, we need to get the values we read from the register into the execute stage, so that better be in a register. So one note is that logically, if you look at this, you'd think, oh, we have a register for RB. That's not quite what our book does, and that's not what we're going to do. We're going to instead have something we call Desti, which is a register number. And we're going to pass that through. So we're going to compute the destination register input earlier than we actually need it. And that's what the book does, and that's what we're going to do. And we don't need to do this, because everything that's in this Desti, you could get from RB and the instruction code. The only difference between Desti and RB is that sometimes Desti will be no register if the instruction code says that this instruction doesn't write to a register, at least not with that input. But we'll find it convenient to actually compute it every time and pass that through instead of RB. And the reason is, as we'll see later, this is going to make handling data hazards easier. Because this is going to give us an easy way to say, oh, does the instruction I'm currently executing eventually write to a register? And we're going to want to know that later next week. And that's why you see in our book that our book doesn't just pass the instruction through, but it computes some things in the decode stage about what registers it writes and what registers it reads. Okay, so with that diversion into how we organize our pipeline, before I'm going to move back to computing the PC, but are there any questions before I move on? Okay, so let's talk about computing the PC now that we've figured out what's in our pipeline registers that we're going to need to do that. So we have three different cases. So we have conditional jumps, where we need something from the instruction that's the jump target, sometimes, and the condition codes. And the condition codes, we said, come from the execute step. We have ret, where we need something from memory. And otherwise, we just need the instruction. So for both of these first two, we need something that isn't available in the fetch stage. And the simplest solution is going to be to stall. So to stall, we're going to have a timeline like we had for handling the data hazard, where we're going to execute some instruction just before our conditional jump. And that's going to give us the value we want in the worst case. So this is the most we need to stall. So we execute that instruction, and it gets to the execute step, sets our value. And in the following clock cycle, we're going to want to actually do the work of the conditional jump. We're going to want to take the condition codes that were just set, if there were any, or the ones that were passed through from a prior instruction, and actually use them to decide what instruction to fetch next. In this case, to go to the IREMOVEQ, since subtracting R8 from R8 better be 0, which better be set be true for JE, because JE looks for the 0 flag being true. So to implement this, we're going to wait two cycles here. And we're going to have one point where we're going to pass through a do nothing instruction. And as far as our written down description of what to do in instructions is concerned, the jump instruction doesn't do much, as you'd usually say. You just say it does something in PC update, and that's it. But we're actually going to do something in execute, so we're going to pass the instruction through. So we're actually going to send the instruction to the decode stage, where it won't do anything because it doesn't read any registers. And from the decode stage, it's going to go to the execute stage, and it's going to have work to do, and that work is going to be to decide whether or not the branch is taken. So we're going to execute the instruction just like it's a normal instruction. As far as the fetch stage is concerned, we're going to pass it through. Just after we send it through, we're not going to keep executing more instructions. We're just going to stop until we get the answer back from its execute stage. And we're going to have the value sent to the instruction by the time it gets into the execute stage to actually make its decision. And using that value, we're going to compute, hey, is this branch actually taken or not? And we're going to send that signal from execute to fetch. So here's the place where we're cheating and doing the thing that you don't do normally and sending a signal between stages, because we actually need to communicate for between this jump instruction and the following instruction to know what the following instruction is. So that's going to change what our PC update looks like. So here's our existing PC update, and we're going to need some extra stuff to not use this incremented value, but to sometimes use the jump target based on that taken signal. And to sometimes not change the PC at all, because we want to stall because we're waiting for that taken signal to be computed. So that means we're going to add another mux. So sometimes we're going to take the existing PC. Sometimes we're going to take the jump target from the instruction. Otherwise, we're just going to use the normal incrementing. And we need to have some control logic here. And that logic is going to use that taken signal that we compute in the execute and something else to decide which one of these to choose. We'll talk about what that something else is in a bit. Now, this arrangement would work, and I would think makes the most sense. But our book has decided that they don't want to do this before the PC register. They want to do it after the PC register. So all they're doing is instead storing the value on this wire in a register instead of the value on this wire, and moving the computation across the clock cycle boundary. So this doesn't change what computation we're doing, it just changes exactly when we do it. So in one case, we're doing it before we fetch that I remove Q instruction, that's the target of the jump. In other cases, we're doing it in the same cycle as we fetch it. Our book thinks that this makes more sense. The logic is that you'd really like to compute the address as close as possible to fetching it, and this is a way to do that. But it's not actually necessary. We could do it before, but our book doesn't, so I'm going to do it afterwards. And that means that instead of storing the PC, we're going to say that this register here stores the predicted PC, because it's not always the address of the instruction we'll be executing. It just mostly is. And so we're going to have this control logic, which is going to look at the taken signal, which, because we can't use it until after it computes, is going to need to come from a register. The jump instruction is going to be in the memory phase at the time we need to decide to fetch the target of the jump. So the taken signal is going to come from a pipeline register somewhere instead of from a computation in this case. And the jump target we can still get from our usual instruction memory, we could, but we're actually going to want to get it from a pipeline register because we're going to use the instruction memory in the same phase. So as with the previous arrangement, this jump target could come from the instruction memory. With this new arrangement, it better not. It needs to come from a register because we haven't read the instruction memory yet this cycle. So given that, we're going to compute the taken in the execute step of the jump instruction and actually start executing the next instruction in the memory step. The way our computation of the taken signal is going to look is something like this, that we're going to get from the decode step the function code, the condition code for the jump instruction. And we're going to use that with a mux to decide whether or not it's taken based on what type of computation the condition code says to do. And we're going to put that in a register, one of our pipeline registers, and the fetch stage is going to just read that register from us to actually decide what address to send to the instruction memory. So what I didn't mention yet exactly is what this extra logic here is. So we need to know, okay, did we just start running the jump instruction but not get the result yet? Have we finished the jump instruction? Or are we not running any jump instruction? So where might we find that out? So this is our logic. We want to know whether or not we need to wait or whether we need to start executing the thing after the jump. Where can we find the information about what step in that we are in? Are we in the waiting step? Are we in the start running the thing after the jump step? Or are we not executing a jump at all? What should we look at? What's one thing that we definitely need to look at? So people are confused. So let's look at what's going to happen as we execute this. So the first case is easy. We know when we start executing a jump that we can look at what the I code we're going to send to the next step, the output of the instruction memory, say, oh, we just fetched a jump. So we can at least detect when we start executing a jump pretty easily. And if we're just going to send this I code off to the decode step, it's going to turn out in the next step that the decode registers are going to have that I code. So we don't actually need any extra state tracking. We could have an extra register to say how many steps has it been since we started the jump, but we don't need that because we already are storing the I code and for each stage, and we can look at that I code and say, oh, are we still executing a jump now? We can look at say, oh, there's a jump into code. That means I need to wait. And similarly, we can say, oh, there's a jump in execute. That means that next cycle I'm going to have my value ready, but I still need to wait now. And later on, when we actually want to use the result that we stored in that taken register, we can say, oh, there's a jump in its memory stage. It's not doing anything, but that means it finished its execute computation, so the value from the taken register is ready for us. So I can use that to figure out what instruction to fetch and actually get the IR move queue that's the target of the jump. So that means when you're writing HCL, you might have code something like this, where we look at that I code from the memory stage. And based on whether or not it's a jump and whether it's taken or not, we could decide whether to use the target of the jump, which needs to come from somewhere, or the output of the register as usual. So, any questions about this logic here? Yeah.
When the I code for JXX gets to the memory stage, then it knows that it can start, it can make a jump?
So when it gets to the memory stage, we have this is in the execute stage. So we've gotten to the memory stage, this register has a value set that is useful. It will also have a value set in other stages, but it won't be from the jump instruction, it will be from something else. It's whether or not we want to take the jump.
Okay.
Other questions? Comments? No. Okay. So that's handling the jump case, and return is easier, actually. So for return, we're going to do the same logic to wait. We're going to know that, oh, if we're executing a return instruction still, we can't get our next instruction because we don't know what that actually is. So we're just going to look at, say, oh, the decode stage, its current opcode is return. I can't do anything yet in the fetch stage. And eventually, when return gets to write back, our value will be ready and we can fetch the actual instruction that comes after the return. And we have to wait at least this long. There's no way we can cheat, because in the worst case, we could have a call immediately followed by a return. So in the worst case, the value that we want to read from memory is only in memory by the time we get to the memory stage of our return instruction. So one question you might have is that since we're figuring out what the actual address is to fetch in the fetch stage, we aren't actually requiring it to be stored in that PC register. We don't have a PC register anymore. We have this guest PC register. That why can't we just start running the instruction here, this add queue in the fifth step, right in the same time we fetch it from memory? So what would might be a reason we're not doing that? Why are we waiting an extra step? So why, you know, we could just put a wire from the data memory all the way to this logic we have to decide whether to use the predicted PC or not, whether to use the jump target or not. And we could do that. And it would actually work. This is like something which would function. So why does the book decide not to do this? No guesses? So let's look at what this would mean for our pipeline. So remember last time I said that when we want to figure out how slow a pipeline is, we need to look for the longest path between two sets of registers or other things which store values. And in this case, that longest path is going to be this one. So it works, but this means that for the worst case time for a clock cycle, it's going to need to have a signal go all the way from this set of registers after the execute through the data memory to read a value, all the way up and around through this logic here and through the instruction memory and into this set of registers after the fetch stage. And that would work, but it turns out that the instruction memory and the data memory are some of the slowest components in our processor. So that means that our cycle time would need to be very large in order to accommodate this. So it would function, but it would mean that we can't run our processor very fast. That we'd still be executing one instruction for a cycle, but our cycle would need to be much longer than it would otherwise, just because we need to fit a data memory read and an instruction memory read in a cycle. Even though we don't use that all the time, we still need to set our cycle time based on the worst possible case. And so this would make our processor very slow. So to avoid this, what we do instead is this. We put it in a register after the data memory and read it from that register. And this means that our worst case paths are going to be through the data memory once, or through this logic before the instruction memory and the instruction memory once, which is much better. So it's not that it wouldn't work, it's just that it would be slow. And that's going to be true in general, because we know our single cycle processor works. So we could always, remove a set of pipeline registers. It's just going to be slow. Could remove a stage, and we could do more work in a pipeline stage than we're supposed to. We could decide that, I'm going to move this set of registers before the register file and just read the register file and do computation in the same stage. That would work, but it's going to be slow because the register file and the computation together are going to end up determining how fast we can have our clock cycle be. So this is our wiring for RET, and that's why we're going to wait a whole four cycles. Because even though we could make RET wait three cycles, the cost of doing that would be making our processor slower all the time for everything else. Okay, so that's our basic ways of handling PC update. So we're going to do a somewhat more advanced technique, which to handle jumps than we did before. But first, to do that, we're going to look at when instructions actually make changes, other than to pipeline registers. So pipeline registers are just temporary values. They don't actually form part of the state that the programmer knows about. The things the programmer knows about are memory and registers and condition codes and the status register. And condition codes, we just said, we're going to change in the execute step. So that's the first stage in which anything that the programmer actually sees changes. Memory, we change in the memory step. And registers, we read them in the decode step, but we don't actually change them to the write-back step. And this is very convenient for us, because it means that, let's say, we wanted to undo an instruction. Now, we issued an instruction, and we said, oops, that was a mistake. I don't like that. I don't want that to happen. It turns out that if the instruction doesn't finish the execute step, that undoing the instruction is just clearing out its pipeline registers. It doesn't have any other effects that we need to worry about. All we need to worry about is what's in those pipeline registers. So if an instruction got all the way to the execute step, we just need to make sure it doesn't change the condition codes this cycle, and just forget what's in its pipeline registers. Take the output of its pipeline registers and don't put them anywhere useful. That's all we need to do to not execute the instruction anymore. If we waited till the memory step, we'd be in trouble because we could have overwritten some condition codes and we wouldn't have an old value stored anywhere. But as long as we stop before the end of the execute step, we could actually execute an instruction and undo it if we're not supposed to. And this is going to be useful for handling jumps. So what we're going to do for jumps is, instead of stalling all the time, we're going to make a guess. We're going to start executing some instructions, and we're just going to make sure they don't actually write anything to the condition codes until we're sure that we actually should be running them. So we're going to make sure our guess is safe by undoing our guess if it ends up being wrong, and making sure we know whether or not it's right or wrong before it makes any effects that are going to be hard for us to undo. So, for example, in this case, we could speculate that this jump goes to this label. And that means we would execute the subtract instruction, we'd start executing the jump instruction, we'd send it on the pipeline to compute that branch taken code that we'll need later. But instead of waiting to get that branch taken signal back from the execute step, we're going to just start executing this add and this RM move queue. And if we get that branch taken signal and it says no, we're just going to get rid of the information we have in pipeline registers for this add and move queue and replace them with some do nothing, with a no op, to make sure that we don't actually write to R9 for this add and that we don't actually write to memory for this RM move queue. And if we don't have to do that, we're going to be two cycles faster. So instead of spending two cycles not starting any instructions, and therefore two cycles later on not finishing any instructions, we're going to still finish one instruction per cycle if we can guess right. If we can guess wrong, it's exactly as bad as it was before, because we're going to spend two cycles not doing anything, but we did that anyways when we were just stalling unconditionally. So in the case where we guess right, we're going to run our jump and issue our jump instruction, but instead of waiting to hear back, we're just going to start the add, but we're guessing. And that add is going to get to the decode stage and is going to start reading registers by the time that our jump instruction is looking at the condition codes. And when we guess right, we look at the result of the jump and say, oh, we were right, and we just fetch the next instruction as usual. So in the case where we speculate right, all this logic looks like it would look in your single cycle processor, and it happens we get a signal which says that you don't need to do anything special. You just did what you did in your single cycle processor, that you, like you would do for an unconditional jump, since we guessed that the jump would be taken. And we had these two guessed instructions, and they were right, so we don't do anything. We just, they aren't guessed anymore, they're actually the real things. And this is where we've saved our two cycles. So the tricky case is if we guessed wrong. So in this case, you know, we get to the execute step, and it puts a result in that register which says, nope, the branch wasn't taken. So then when we're deciding what instruction to fetch in this fifth time step, we're not going to fetch the following IRMOVEQ instruction here, we're going to fetch this XOR. But we're also going to have to do a little bit of extra work. We're going to have to say, take the values that the decode stage for add put in the registers, and we're going to have to make sure those values don't do anything anymore. So we're going to replace the I code for add that's currently in a register between decode and execute with a no-op. We're going to replace the I code for RMOVEQ that's currently, that would otherwise be in a register between fetch and decode, and replace that with a no-op. So we're going to need extra logic later in the pipeline, but our PC update logic is actually not any more complicated. And this is often known as squashing, this replacing these wrong guesses with doing nothing. Because it's another way of saying undoing the instruction. And in our processor, because we don't do anything until we have our actual guess confirmed, we don't do anything that changes state outside of pipeline registers, squashing is very easy. It's just having that mux in front of the pipeline register, which has a do nothing option, and setting the input to that mux. We'll talk more about that later, but it's actually pretty simple. And some real processors try to do this, but they wait until later, and that makes it much more complicated, where you have to like undo a register write. But we don't have that problem. We don't have to undo anything, we just have to stop, take instructions we were executing and just not use the results anymore. And we just move on, fetch the next instruction. And this, you know, in our previous version, it would be the same timeline, except we'd have do nothing in these slots earlier for where we have these guessed instructions. So we haven't lost anything besides a little bit more complicated logic to replace something with nothing instead of just passing nothing through as usual. So any questions about how this timeline works? Okay, so our book does this branch prediction, so, you know, which gets rid of our stalling logic and replaces it with squashing logic, so it's basically probably easier, maybe, or the same difficulty. But one of the decisions we have to make in doing this is, what guess are we going to make? Do we assume that we fetch the instruction following the jump, or do we assume that we fetch the label that the jump points to? And the book has chosen to assume that all jumps are taken. So there's one reason to do this that I don't mention here, is that, well, it turns out that unconditional jumps are always taken, and this means that you have the same code to handle unconditional jumps and conditional jumps. But another reason to do this is that there's an empirical observation. There's no way you could actually know this besides looking at programs. But people have done studies where they've looked at real programs. And when they've done this, they found out that most branches are taken. This doesn't have to be true. You can easily construct programs where most branches aren't taken. You can easily write branches that will never be taken in your programs. But empirically, most branches are taken. And the intuition for why this happens, for what people are doing, which means that most branches are taken, is that loops typically have a conditional branch at the bottom, because that's the minimum number of branches for a loop when generated by a compiler. And most of the time, a loop branch will be taken. If you have a loop that's executed 100 times, like a for loop, that branch will be taken 99% of the time. So this is the reason why this is probably the best strategy. But you had no way of knowing that, because we could easily imagine all our compilers might generate code where we have more untaken branches. Okay. So given that we've made the right choice for our static prediction here, let's talk about like what this does for performance. How much did we actually save by doing this branch prediction, by making this guess and rather than stalling? So what do we need to know how much time we're saving? Like, how would you, if I wanted you to tell me how much does this help, what questions would you ask me about what I should assume in order to have an answer? Yeah.
How long each cycle takes regularly?
Okay, so one question you'd have is, well, this is some extra logic maybe. So what's the difference in the time per cycle? So that's one issue, is that doing this branch prediction might take a little extra logic, so how much is that adding? Are there any other things you'd want to know in order to know what the difference in performance is? So let's say someone has implemented really good branch prediction on their y86 processor, and I didn't. And I want to make their processor look bad. What do I do? What program do I run to show that their processor is bad? Yeah.
Take a lot of conditional jumps that aren't taken.
Yeah, so if they do taken branch prediction, I can just figure out how their branch predictor works and produce the program which exactly has it make the wrong predictions. So what does that mean we should actually want to know in order to know how much this is helping us? What's one thing we'd like to know? How many times we're going to actually be right. We'd like to know, what does a real program look like? How often are we actually going to be right? And we know that that can vary, because we know that me, as the person trying to make a processor look bad, can construct a program where they're never right. Or I can even have a program with no jumps. Their branch prediction won't matter for that. Doesn't matter how good they are. If there's no jumps, they can't help. So we also need to know, like, how often are there jumps? If you have a program with no jumps, this didn't help you any. So what we might ask you, and what commonly people do in about looking at like what their processor design should look like, is they look at what is often called an instruction mix. Like, when you run a program, what portion of the instructions you run are of each type? So we can say, well, how many instructions are not taken jumps? How many are taken jumps? How many are returns? And how many are anything else? And for each of these instructions, depending on how we implement our processor, they take a different amount of time to execute. So most instructions take one, because we're ignoring some things that we'll talk about next week. And our mispredicted jumps take three. Our correctly predicted jumps take one with prediction, three with a stall, and our returns take four. And given that, we can compute what the average time that each instruction takes. So 3% of the instructions take three cycles because they're not taking jumps. 5% are taking jumps, so with prediction, they take one cycle. With stalling, they take three. And we can add that all up, get that compute that weighted average. And we get the average number of cycles that each instruction takes, assuming that this is what our programs look like. And this is cycles per instruction. This is sometimes known as CPI, which I assume is a term that will come up later in the semester more. And this is the big number for evaluating how good our pipelining is. So in addition to this, what the cycle time is, which we're not going to really talk about how we figure out exactly what that is, except that we know it's related to how complex what you're doing in each cycle in the worst case is. We also want to know, how often are we not actually finishing one instruction per cycle? How often are we taking longer? And this is going to tell us that. And we see that even with a very modest number of correctly predicted jumps, only 5% of our instructions are correctly predicted in this instruction mix, we're getting about a 10% improvement in performance. And that's typical. And this is with a very short, simple pipeline. And this is a case where latency really matters. So remember when I talked about pipelining, I talked about it improving throughput, but also hurting latency. And this is a case where latency is exposed, because how much time we have to wait is based on how many steps were between figuring out what the outcome of the jump was and actually fetching an instruction. And if we make that wait longer, this is a case where we're going to pay. And this means that longer, more complicated pipelines, like appear in pretty much any processor, are going to make this penalty higher. And there's a famous story. So Intel released the Pentium 4 around 2000. And the Pentium 4 was a big bet on deeper pipelines. So on release, it had a 50% higher clock rate than its competitors. So conceptually, it should be 50% faster. But it had 2 to 3 times the pipeline stages. It had a, numbers reported vary, depends on how you count pipeline stages, but it had on the order of 30 pipeline stages, when typical for a processor of the time was probably like 5 to 15. And the result was, here's a quote from a review of the first release 1.5 gigahertz Pentium 4. "For today's buyer, the Pentium 4 simply doesn't make sense. It's slower than the competition in just about every area. It's more expensive, and there are a whole bunch of other issues going on." And this wasn't because it didn't have the higher throughput. It did. The Pentium 4 could run more instructions in the best case, but it had a much higher penalty for the cases where you had a mispredicted branch and other types of problems we'll talk about later, where you can't actually issue one instruction every cycle, or in the Pentium 4's case, 4 instructions every cycle. But the same problem, that we had to wait for some result to come back. So that's our cautionary tale about this. The Pentium 4 would have done a lot worse if it used a branch prediction strategy like the one we used. I want to talk briefly about, you know, what can we do better than that. So our branch prediction strategy, it empirically works just because of this observation that usually branches are taken, just because of loops is the, you know, the intuitive explanation, though it might not be the real one. So there's another way we could predict branches, which would be better, but more complicated logic. And that is to assume that if a branch goes to a greater instruction address, that it's taken, that it's not taken, and if it goes to a backwards instruction address, a lesser instruction address, it is taken. And the reason you do this, the reason this intuition works, is also loops. So one way of writing a loop is to have a branch at the end which goes back to the beginning. That's a backwards branch. And if we assume most branches we care about are loops, that's usually taken. So that's the right guess. Another way of writing a loop is to have a condition test at the beginning and an unconditional jump at the end. This test at the beginning is usually not going to be taken. So this strategy performs a lot better than just guessing that a branch is taken. It's probably like 50% better, like 70% accurate on real programs, 70, 80. So that's something you could do. What would be the downside of trying to implement this in our processor? Yeah.
We need to add more logic to calculate whether the target's greater or less than the PC.
Yeah, so we need to add more logic, which means our fetch stage might be slower, which means we might have to make our cycle time higher. Because we need to add that comparator. And comparing to 64-bit numbers might take a while. Okay. So this is sort of an example of some more advanced branch prediction techniques. And branch predictors are some of the most complicated and kept secret, most secret parts of modern processors. It is safe to say that a modern processor probably has, like more area dedicated to branch prediction than like multiplying integers. Because it's that important when you have a 20 or 30 stage pipeline, which is not uncommon, where you're going to wait, where your instructions are going to take 20 times longer when you can't predict a branch correctly. And one thing that might come out of that is, we have this red instruction where we have this annoyance here that even with branch prediction, we can't actually do anything about a ret. Because with a ret, well, we can predict the branch, yeah. We're gonna jump not to a different address. We know that. We know that it's gonna be taken. We just don't know where it goes. And there is actually a solution that real processors use to figure out where the ret will go in advance, most of the time. They guess what the address of the ret is gonna be. And the way they do that is by storing extra information. So you have call instructions, which push something onto the stack in memory. What you can do instead is push something onto the stack in memory and onto a second stack that you keep in some fast register somewhere. So on real CPUs, you'll commonly have a stack in memory, some values, and you'll have another copy of the stack that only stores the return addresses and only the ones that came from call. So does this always work? Could you write a program where these two stacks would differ if they're set the way I said, told you, as far as what return addresses are in there? So what does the call, so could you implement the call instruction without call in assembly? Let's say we didn't have a call instruction. What would you do instead? Yeah.
You push the value of the next instruction after the call, and then you jump to the immediate value.
Yeah, so we could push an address onto the into memory, and then jump to a call. And with this technique, the processor is not going to realize that that's a return address, because it has no way of knowing. And it's not going to put it in its partial stack. So it can be, in the case when you're doing this style of branch prediction, predicting the target of returns, that someone might have done something like that, and your prediction would give the wrong answer. Another thing which could happen is that, well, this is in registers. Our registers don't have nearly as much room as our memory, so it could run out of space. But it's not actually a problem for correctness, because if we guess wrong, we're going to do the same thing we did with a jump that wasn't taken. We're going to undo all the instructions that were pending. So we're going to guess where the return goes. And if we find out by the time we actually read the memory to see the return address that we're wrong, we're going to undo that. Now, if you tried to do this in your y86 processor, besides the fact that you'd need to figure out how to implement this stack in HCLTD, which seems a little complicated, you'd have a little bit of a problem, which is that by the time you know what the real result is to figure out whether you guessed wrong or not, you might have changed condition codes. So real processors also have logic to fix things like that, where they'll like have a backup copy of the condition codes that they can copy back in the case where they guessed wrong. But so for reasons like that, we're not going to have you do this. But you should be aware that in a modern processor, they can predict most of the instructions in the good case. So we're not going to do that. We're just going to predict them sometimes. But you actually can do that. And it's better than that. So in our processor, we do some computation, access the instruction memory, and get a value right away. And that's what we've assumed about all our memories. Their memories are single cycle, give us a value. But real processors aren't so nice. So real instruction memories are often going to be slower than that. So real processors are not only going to need to really do better branch prediction, not just guessing whether jumps are taken or not, they also need to predict branches before they read opcodes. So I'm not going to talk about how that works exactly, except to say that we're going to have more extra data structures like those return stacks that we had an extra copy of in order to do this. But this is, I just want people to be aware of it because you get the wrong idea about what branch prediction is when you do the case where you concede after the instruction. But we also do, in real processors, branch prediction before we even know what the instruction is for sure. And we need to do that because we want to have this do something on every clock cycle. So our ideal case is that we go look at our performance here and that most of these numbers are 1 in the good case. And that we have a few exceptions, you know, are not taken branches and things like that, where they're not 1. But most of the time, we're getting at least 1 instruction every cycle. We're doing work every cycle. We're not having to wait multiple cycles. And so our ideal case for a processor, you know, if we did all this prediction, is going to be that instead of having 1.09, this number for real programs is going to be very, very close to 1. Now we're going to get all the benefit of pipelining that we could possibly get. The reality is, with real processors, that you can almost never get this number. And we're talking about one reason now, which is hazards, that you can't do it. Later in the semester, we'll talk about how memories actually work, which is going to be another reason we can't get 1. But most of the work we're going to be doing from now on in the course is going to be about making this number here as close to 1 as possible. And that's pretty much everything we're doing from today on, I think. Everything? Yeah. Is about getting this number as close to 1 as possible. It's all
exceptions, maybe not.
Maybe not. Yeah. So, but we're not actually going to get there. And numbers like 1.09 are actually very good. And to give an example, so modern processors can execute in the best case like 4 instructions per cycle. So 0.25 cycles per instruction. That's their best case, just like our processor's best case is 1. In reality, a typical number you get for a real program is on par with this, like 1.2. And that's what makes all this extra work worthwhile, and more worthwhile when we have more advanced processors with more pipeline stages and fancier logic. That we're going to, the difference between paying a few extra cycles is going to be, it's going to be more important for those processors. So our overall process, it was that we took our pipeline processor, our single cycle processor, made it pipelined. And the big thing is that we actually paid attention to these stages that were previously just advisory. They didn't really matter before because, you know, it was only a logical organization. Now we're going to make them really concrete. And we know what stage something's in based on what pipeline registers it talks to. So we add pipeline registers to separate the stages, and those pipeline registers define what our stages really are. If you have any questions about what's in what stage, well, it depends what pipeline registers you hooked it up to. It's possible you could move something between stages. You won't be implementing the processor in the book, but if you're doing it in with different pipeline registers, you're doing it in a different stage because it's going to happen in a different cycle in the processor you implement. And our book decided that they wanted to, store in the PC register the normal next PC only and handle the rest of the logic afterwards. So we have our normal case where we choose our PC based on the instruction only. And that's where we store it in the PC. And we handle conditional branches and branches we can't know right away, which is conditional jumps and ret, in a little logic after the PC before the instruction memory. And that needed signals from other stages. So everywhere else, we had our rule that we only talk to the previous stage and the next stage. But because we need to communicate between instructions, we have some exceptions. So just to decide what instruction to run next, we need to look at things that are currently executing out of the fetch stage, because they now have the answer for us. And we use branch prediction. And the book strategy was to assume all branches are taken. They make this assumption, and it's safe because they verify that assumption in time and make sure that nothing happens if they try to verify it and it was wrong. And for return, we didn't have a solution. So there's a one for real processors where we store some extra information to make a similar guess for the return, but we're not going to have you do that. So we're just going to wait. And the way we waited is by looking at the future pipeline registers to decide, are we actually done with the return I sent down a few cycles ago? We used that to stall the instruction. And the end result is that we have our ideal of pipelining where we execute one instruction every cycle. We took our one instruction a cycle processor, and we still have a one instruction a cycle processor, was the ideal. And it just has a shorter cycle time. But we didn't actually get that ideal, because this branch misprediction installing has a penalty. And depending on what our programs are, that penalty can be as large as executing three or four times slower to executing more likely 10 or 20% slower than the ideal time for a pipeline processor. So any questions? Comments? Fusion? Okay, so next time, we're going to talk about how we actually deal with data hazards. So today, we dealt with control hazards. But next time, we'll deal with data hazards and refine a bit, probably, how we deal with control hazards. And most of the time, it ends up that we're going to deal with data hazards without stalling. So we'll be mostly very close to this one number here. Mostly.